For the members of the former, a man would vote by his calling, for the latter, by his district of residence. They point out that the British House of Lords is in effect a body representing function, in which the land, the law, and the church are no doubt disproportionately represented, but in which industrialism, finance, the great public services, art, science, and medicine also find places, and that the British House of Commons is purely geographical in its reference. It's even been suggested in Britain that there should be Labour peers, selected from among the leaders of the great industrial trade unions, but these are speculations beyond our present scope. The central government of the United States was at first a very feeble body, a Congress of Representatives of the 13 governments, held together by certain Articles of Confederation. This Congress was little more than a conference of sovereign representatives. It had no control, for instance, over the foreign trade of each state. It couldn't coin money, nor levy taxes by its own authority. When John Adams, the first minister from the United States to England, went to discuss a commercial treaty with the British Foreign Secretary, he was met by a request for 13 representatives, one from each of the states concerned. He had to confess his inadequacy to make binding arrangements. The British presently began dealing with each state separately over the head of Congress, and they retained possession of a number of posts in the American territory about the Great Lakes, because of the inability of Congress to hold these regions effectually. In another urgent matter, Congress proved equally feeble. To the west of the 13 states stretched limitless lands into which settlers were now pushing in ever-increasing numbers. Each of the states had indefinable claims to expansion westward. It was evident to every clear-sighted man that the jostling of these claims must lead, in the long run, to war, unless the central government could take on their apportionment. The feebleness of the central government, its lack of concentration, became so much of an inconvenience and so manifest a danger that there was some secret discussion of a monarchy. At Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts, the president of Congress, caused Prince Henry of Prussia, the brother of Frederick the Great, to be approached on the subject. Finally, a constitutional convention was called in 1787 at Philadelphia, and there it was that the present Constitution of the United States was, in its broad lines, hammered out. A great change of spirit had gone on during the intervening years, a widespread realization of the need of unity. When the Articles of Confederation were drawn up, men had thought of the people of Virginia, the people of Massachusetts, the people of Rhode Island, and the like, but now there appears a new conception, the people of the United States. The new government, with the executive president, the senators, congressmen, and the Supreme Court that was now created, was declared to be the government of the people of the United States. It was a synthesis and not a mere assembly. It said, "We the people," and not "we the states," as Lee of Virginia bitterly complained. It was to be a federal and not a confederate government. State by state, the new constitution was ratified, and in the spring of 1788, the first Congress upon the new lines assembled at New York, under the presidency of George Washington, who had been the national commander-in-chief throughout the War of Independence. The Constitution then underwent considerable revision, and Washington, upon the Potomac, was selected as the federal capital. Sixth. In an earlier chapter, we've described the Roman Republic and its mixture of modern features with dark superstition and primordial savagery as the Neanderthal anticipation of the modern democratic state. A time may come when people will regard the contrivances and machinery of the American Constitution as the political equivalents of the implements and contrivances of Neolithic man. They've served their purpose well, and under their protection the people of the states have grown into one of the greatest, most powerful, and most civilized communities that the world has yet seen. But there's no reason in that for regarding the American Constitution as a thing more final and inalterable than the pattern of street railway that overshadows many New York thoroughfares, or the excellent and homely type of house architecture that still prevails in Philadelphia. These things also have served a purpose well. They have their faults, and they can be improved. Our political contrivances, just as much as our domestic and mechanical contrivances, need to undergo constant revision as knowledge and understanding grow. Since the American Constitution was planned, our conception of history and our knowledge of collective psychology has undergone very considerable development. We're beginning to see many things in the problem of government to which the men of the 18th century were blind. And courageous as their constructive disposition was in relation to whatever political creation had gone before, it fell far short of the boldness which we in these days realize to be needful if this great human problem of establishing a civilized community of will in the earth is to be solved. They took many things for granted that now we know need to be made the subject of the most exacting scientific study and the most careful adjustment. They thought it was only necessary to set up schools and colleges with a grant of land for maintenance, and that they might then be left to themselves. But education is not a weed that will grow lustily in any soil. It's a necessary and delicate crop that may easily wilt and degenerate. We learn nowadays that the underdevelopment of universities and educational machinery is like some underdevelopment of the brain and nerves, which hampers the whole growth of the social body. By European standards, by the standard of any state that has existed hitherto, the level of the common education of America is high, but by the standard of what it might be, America is an uneducated country. And those fathers of America thought also that they had but to leave the press free and everyone would live in the light. They didn't realize that a free press could develop a sort of constitutional venality due to its relations with advertisers, and that large newspaper proprietors could become buccaneers of opinion and insensate wreckers of good beginnings. And finally, the makers of America had no knowledge of the complexities of vote manipulation. The whole science of elections was beyond their ken. They knew nothing of the need of the transferable vote to prevent the working of elections by specialized organizations, and the crude and rigid methods they adopted left their political system the certain prey of the great party machines that have robbed American democracy of half its freedom and most of its political soul. Politics became a trade, and a very base trade. Decent and able men, after the first great period, drifted out of politics and attended to business, and what I called elsewhere the sense of the state declined. Private enterprise ruled in many matters of common concern because political corruption made collective enterprise impossible. Yet the defects of the great political system created by the Americans of the revolutionary period didn't appear at once. For several generations, the history of the United States was one of rapid expansion and of an amount of freedom, homely happiness, and energetic work unparalleled in the world's history. And the record of America for the whole last century and a half, in spite of many reversions towards inequality, in spite of much rawness and much blundering, is nevertheless as bright and honorable a story as that of any other contemporary people. In this brief account of the creation of the United States of America, we've been able to do little more than mention the names of some of the group of great men who made this new departure in human history. We've named casually, or we've not even named, such men as Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, the Adams cousins, Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and George Washington. It's hard to measure the men of one period of history with those in another. Some writers, even American writers, impressed by the artificial splendors of the European courts and by the tawdry and destructive exploits of a Frederick the Great, or a great Catherine, display a snobbish shame for something homespun about these makers of America. They feel that Benjamin Franklin, at the court of Louis XVI, with his long hair, his plain clothes, and his porky manner, was sadly lacking in aristocratic distinction. But stripped to their personalities, Louis XVI was hardly gifted enough or noble-minded enough to be Franklin's valet.